Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
My name is Camille. I also have the Dharma name of Dawu, and I'll talk about that actually a little bit more in my Way Seeking Mind talk. So for anyone who's not so familiar with these talks, the idea is for me to share a little bit about my spiritual journey, how I came to Zen, what's happening with my practice. And the idea is to try to strengthen our Sangha, our community here, by getting to know one another a little bit better. And you can listen in my talk and notice what's coming up for you. Are there things that are resonant with your own experience, or some things that are really different? At the organization where I work, we call that mirrors and windows, and we encourage the teachers to bring into their classroom some mirrors for the children, like a book that would reflect their own backgrounds, and then windows into other people's experiences. So I'll start with where I was born and grew up, which is South Pasadena in Southern California. And I was an only child and was not raised with a religion very much, I wouldn't say. My parents, I think, were following in my mother's father's footsteps in sort of identifying more as secular humanists, I would say. And, you know, that definitely resonated with me, and it still resonates with me, this idea of really caring for everyone and that sort of being the North Star. And so one of the things that I want to talk about today is kind of carrying this question in my life. How can I care for myself and others, and how that's come up in different ways, and how different people have modeled that for me in different ways. And I really appreciated that where I was growing up in LA, my parents were helping me to see the inequality that was all around us. And I felt I could see it just at the end of my street. I lived at the edge of South Pasadena, which was its own school district. And so if you went down one block, you're in Los Angeles. And both places were very diverse in somewhat different ways. And so they were just very rich culturally, and you know, just great places to be in a lot of ways. And I also saw how the resources that were given to schools, for example, both my parents are in education as well, so we were often talking about that, were just so different when you went one block away from where I grew up. And so I just was carrying this question, like, how are we not caring for everyone in the same way? It just always seemed so wrong to me. And those were the discussions we were having around the dinner table. And there was this wish to be able to do something as I grew up. And at the same time, there were things that were always difficult for me internally. And like a lot of us, suffering in particular from perfectionism, anxiety, things like that. I remember back in high school that I would lie down and just, it would take me a long time to fall asleep. I'd be replaying all these moments from my day and worrying about them. Maybe I hadn't handled them well. You know, maybe the next day something bad was going to happen because of what I did the day before, that sort of thing. So, yeah, and I didn't really have the tools or the knowledge of how to care for that. You know, people just sort of say, don't do that, you know, and it's like, oh, now I just feel worse. So I was very fortunate to have a study hall teacher when I was in my sophomore year of high school, who I just thought was cool. I didn't know why. He just seemed to actually listen to the students and learn from the high school students instead of sort of just always trying to tell us what to do and impose his ideas of things. And he just seemed curious, like he was always questioning everything. Like I remember one time complaining that my Spanish teacher would take 10 minutes to take roll and it was so boring. We're just sitting there. And he said, "Isn't that interesting to be bored? What is it like to be bored?" You know, and I was like, oh, okay. I guess I'll pay attention to that. And it turned out he was a Zen Buddhist. And he gave me a copy of this book called Nothing Happens Next by Sherry Huber, which is great for beginners because it has things actually in question and answer form, all the questions that come up oftentimes right when you're starting out. Like I remember looking up in that book, what should I do when I get itchy during Zazen? And it was really helpful. As I remember, it was basically like, notice it, you know, try to see what happens. If you don't scratch it, you'll probably be okay. You'll probably survive. You know, if you're really going crazy, you can do it mindfully. So I from early on just thought, why don't we all learn this in school? This is the most valuable thing that I've ever learned in school about just how to be. And so I carried that question with me, and I continue to. So then I went on and moved across the country for college, and I went to Smith College in Western Massachusetts. And it's part of a 5-college system, which actually is also the 5 characters in Scooby-Doo. I were created as the 5 different colleges. So that's another story that I can tell you about sometime, but it's a very fun and quirky area. And we had a 5-college Zen chaplain from Japan. So that was really wonderful to somehow just land and have this great teacher on our campus much of the time. He would cook us soup and bread for lunch, and we'd come and sit meditation and talk. And I remember I was pretty annoying at the time. Like I was going through this stage where I was just so excited about Buddhism. I thought it was the best thing ever, was talking about it all the time. And some of my friends were rolling their eyes, and Ishin, you know, our teacher from Japan, would just, I would ask him questions like, I'm taking an economics class, like, how does this relate to Zen, and how can we bring in Zen with the self? And you'd just be like, sometimes, you know, that it's not everything is Zen, like, just relax, you know. But yeah, it was also, you know, something that I remember back to, and I still feel sometimes that just sort of excitement that these teachings exist. And I also took a class called The Politics of Enlightenment, which was quite interesting. It was the only Buddhism class that I took at Smith. And it was all about how does Buddhism show up in the world, and how does it intersect with politics and culture? And we got to go visit local temples. There was temples from the Cambodian refugee community that had been built with this amazing all neon Buddha with the waterfall, and there was chanting and donations and food, and it was just community, really strong sense of community. And we also learned about all the really messy ways that Buddhism in many places will intersect with reasons to other people and even engage in war. And so I think that was helpful too in this stage that I was going through of over enthusiasm, to also have some reality check as well. Like, this is, Buddhism still intersects with all of our human tendencies. And, you know, I've continued to see that, of course, in different communities that I've been part of over the years. So during college, I just continued to ask this question about how can I help, how can I care for myself and others, how can I help with inequality, was definitely something that was alive for me. And I first thought that maybe I would go into international development. And then I spent my junior year abroad in Buenos Aires. And I somehow, that experience of being in Argentina, I really saw that even after a year, I didn't really get anything. Like, you know, like a little bit, but like to be actually able to help something in that society without deeply knowing the history and things like that. Yeah, it was quite humbling. And at the same time, I saw so many things there, like, wow, you can go to really great university classes at the University of Buenos Aires for free, things like that. And I started to think, okay, you know, of course there's plenty to be done in the US, and maybe I'm better situated to do that. And so I decided, okay, well, one of the only ways that we seem to be able to address inequality in the US, you know, we have healthcare, and then there's also education. And so I decided to go into education, and I wanted to, even then I thought, I want to work at a structural level. I didn't see myself as a classroom teacher in the long term, but I wanted to start as a classroom teacher and have that firsthand knowledge of what it was like to be a teacher. And so I went into Teach for America, which is a program that places you in a teaching position and you're making a commitment for 2 years. And I was teaching, I was assigned to teach high school math in Memphis, Tennessee. There was a lot of shock for me when I arrived at the school, to be honest. The school had, was going to be fresh started the next year, which means everyone was going to be fired if we didn't make adequate yearly progress on the tests that they were taking for No Child Left Behind, which they had never done this. So I was teaching algebra. Half of the kids had failed the algebra exam the year before. And it was also an exit exam for high school. So if you fail this exam, you cannot graduate from high school. So the principal gave a talk that I remember as the "You Will Have Blood on Your Hands" talk. And he said, if your kids don't pass your class in this test — he was saying this to all the faculty, but I was really hearing it for me — you know, then they're not going to graduate from high school. If they don't graduate from high school, then there's a really high probability that they're going to go to prison. If they go to prison, something else violent and terrible is going to happen, and you will have blood on your hands. So I was 22. I'd had 6 weeks of training that summer, and I'd never been to Memphis before. And I was scared, and I was right to be scared. And it's still really heartbreaking when I think about it, because what I don't want is for people to have this idea like there's something wrong with Memphis, or there's something wrong with the kids. You know, I think that's an important aspect of our Buddhist practice, is to know that these are all Buddhas, and And that was something that really helped me and supported me. And at the same time, it really showed me a lot of the systemic issues, systemic racism over time, that were just quite overwhelming to me, and just a huge amount of dysfunction at the school, which is a long story that I can tell you about another time if you would like to know all the details. And there were wonderful things. Like the students did know that I cared for them, that I loved them, and I said it all the time, and I had no classroom management skills and things were often chaotic, but they made it through and we made adequate yearly progress, and all but three of the kids who like actually attended school passed the exam. And you know, I came back one day to my classroom when I had been out at the end of the year, and there was like thank you notes up on the board, including from some of the students who I thought hated me, in part because they would say things that sounded like they did, but they're teenagers. And and then in my second year, I completely burnt out and I had to leave. And it was so hard. I think the hardest thing was feeling like, here I am, another person abandoning these students who just deserve so much better in society. But at the same time, it was a question of my own health and mental health. And there's a lot that I look at there, you know, in terms of my own white savior complex, I think was playing in just the way that I confused my own self-worth with how things were going in the classroom. Ways that I wish that I had been able to enact some of the things that we know from Buddhism about just being able to have some greater equanimity and healthy amount of being able to let go of things. And at the same time, I think it just gives me a huge amount of compassion for people who are teaching in these sorts of situations and in the entire communities when there's just really difficult systemic issues at play. And it also drove home for me again, this like, wow, how much could mindfulness be a healing factor in these environments where there was so much trauma. There was, on the part of students and communities and teachers, and that was something that I really saw. And I thought, it's not enough in and of itself. We need to look at these systemic things and combine them. When I was at Tassajara, I spent quite a bit of my first practice period there crying. And most of the crying was just remembering things that had happened when I was teaching. And there we only get 20 minutes for a way seeking mind talk, and somehow most of mine ended up being about what happened when I was teaching, because that's just what was bubbling up and needed to be looked at and healed. So after my first semester of teaching high school, I was craving just silence and peace. And I went home to LA and I Googled mindfulness retreat, Christmas, New Year's, something like that. And there was one that came up, a retreat that was happening between December 26th and New Year's, right there in the middle of LA. And that was at the Hazy Moon Zen Center. And there was a lot of peace in terms of that there were no kids running around and screaming and so on, like there was at high school often. And at the same time, we were right in the middle of LA. And so I went to see the teacher for an interview and, you know, for Doka-san. And I said, it's the ice cream trucks. There are three ice cream trucks on this street. They're all going at the same time, playing their songs, and they're all off key. And I was just like, I'm trying to sit Sazen. And he said, what are you gonna do about it? And that really hit me. And that's another kind of koan that I carry around. Like, yeah, there. And I kept practicing there. I ended up doing that same end of year retreat for 11 years in a row. And I went back quite a bit. They would have summer practice periods. And so if I was teaching or a student, that was a good time to go. And I did make peace with the ice cream trucks. I sort of was like, okay, this is what's happening. And it was a good teaching. So I took my Jukai there in 2013 and went through this lay ordination ceremony and got my name, which is Dawu. I don't say it properly. It's a Chinese Dharma name, so it's more like Da Wu Wu. It goes down on the second tone. And the teacher chose this name from a book called The Daughters of Emptiness, and it tells the stories of Chan nuns over different centuries in China. So my namesake was born at the end of the 19th century, and she was supposed to get married, and then the guy she was gonna marry died, and she told her parents that she didn't wanna find somebody else to marry. She wanted to become a Chan nun, and they said no. So she ran away from home and she went to this rundown monastery and she helped. The community saw how dedicated she was as a practitioner, and so they donated and it became a more thriving Chan center again. So that's part of the reason why I really like using my Dharma name in Zen centers, because I just find her story so inspiring. So after my time in Memphis, I moved to Washington, D.C., went into education research, was really lucky to find more Sangha there, more practice, and so on. And then after a couple of years there, I got into the PhD program in education at Stanford, so that was an opportunity to move back to California, to the Bay Area for the first time for me. And so then it also gave me a chance to sit for a full month at the Hazy Moon that summer, which was just really wonderful. And I also got to go to Japan for a couple of weeks. And I didn't actually practice at monasteries there or anything. I was staying with a friend, but I did get to go to during Obon to Nara, which is, they have like the old capital there and this temple, and just for like twice a year they open it up and you see the huge Buddha, and you come in and there's the chanting going on in the distance and it gets louder as you go in, and there's the lanterns everywhere with messages, and that was quite an amazing experience. It felt to me like going back in time. And so I feel, yeah, just really fortunate to have that experience before I jumped in to my PhD program. And during my time at Stanford, I very early on got quite ill. And it's a chronic illness that I've been sort of managing since that time. Something happened in my digestive system, and they don't know what, but it started quite suddenly and has never fully recovered. And, you know, continue to work on it, and I feel like, you know, managing it okay. But that was definitely a challenge. I mean, it was challenging enough, you know, going through this doctoral program and then, just also feeling ill and not knowing why. And sort of at the end of my third year of grad school, I started to really feel like I need to do something different. I need to kind of take a break, and several things were coming to me. One of them was that I really wanted to try to take care of my body, and one of the ways to do that could be to go work remotely from the Hazy Moon Zen Center for a little while, you know, see an acupuncturist down there that my friends had recommended and so on. And then I also was, you know, really taking that time to realize that I was passionate, yes, about all different ways to deal with inequality, and my work at Stanford had to do with helping multilingual learners so that they could learn English and maintain their home language, and with working with schools to reduce absences and all sorts of things related to that. And at the same time, I just got clear that what I was most passionate about was mindfulness and education, and that I do see that as a way, like I say, that can be combined with a more systemic lens and work around creating more equality as well. So, you know, I kind of got all that, but then I was like, I need to finish my PhD. I sort of, you know, found the papers I needed to write to do that. I started getting definitely healthier and more stable from seeing this acupuncturist. And then after my time at Stanford, I actually got to work at a place called Mindful Schools, and they provide mindfulness education training to educators, or they did until they recently closed up shop. And it was one of those things where I was like, this is the best thing ever. This is my dream job. And then eventually, and there was wonderful things. There's teachers doing just amazing things in their classroom, and we're human beings, and it was very dysfunctional, and to the point also that's why I ended up losing my job really suddenly, and the organization had to close eventually because of just mismanagement. And so that was quite a jolt, you know, just losing my job that suddenly, feeling like I had been so into it, and then now what? And meanwhile, I had met Tim in 2016. And so then I lost my job in March 2017, and pretty soon after said, you know, Tim, you've been talking about going back to Tassajara. I don't have a job now, like, let's go. And so that's what we did. And so I thought I was just gonna be there for 3 months in the summer. And it ended up that I stayed for the rest of that summer, and then three more practice periods in the fall and the winter. So that first practice period was the 100th practice period at Tassajara with Reb Anderson, and just had this excitement going in and this sort of vitality to it that, like, you know, we're getting up at 3:50 in the morning and everybody is showing up every period. It was quite amazing. And Reb was funny because when he came in, he was like, I've been kind of dreading this, like, those practice periods are hard. And then by the end, I think everyone's energy had lifted him, and he just kept saying, this is so amazing and wonderful. And there's just nothing like that. So I do feel fortunate that I lost that job and I was put in this position where I could go and really dive into practice as a monk in that way. And so, yeah, we got to stay on. And in the meantime, Tim and I got married in a Zen ceremony at City Center in September 2018. And yeah, it was just a really wonderful, wonderful time to be able to spend at Tassajara, and hard. Like getting up at 3:50 in the morning is just really brutal for me and my body, and having that illness and so on. Eventually it just wasn't going to be sustainable staying there, unfortunately. And so we left Tassajara in September of 2019, and we had asked for our wedding in lieu of gifts for travel money. And so we took 3 months and traveled in Southern Africa, where Tim had lived for 5 years, in Eswatini, and went on to Southeast Asia. We got to sit a 10-month Vipassana retreat at Wat Swan Muk in Southern Thailand. And, you know, as much as I love Zen, Tim and I both really, really loved that retreat and loved the smiling. Like once in a while, I think it is nice to have a retreat where people smile at each other. So I'm always kind of holding that, like I like the Zen forms, and then I'm also enjoy exploring these other traditions that bring in a different flavor like that. So we spent the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, in the shelter in place at City Center. And I got a job that we were supposed to go to Bhutan and live in Bhutan, which was so exciting because, one, the job was all about creating this new way of education that they were piloting in Bhutan and going to spread around the world. And it's, you know, was not just cognitive, but also social, emotional, and physical, and spiritual. And it's this Buddhist country. And so we were so excited, and we signed the contract, and we were sold our car and our stuff and moved out, and we're all ready to go. And then got the call that somebody in the government had nixed the whole thing, 6 months after initially signing the paperwork. So that was rough. So at this point we're at August of 2021. And so, yeah, we needed to figure out another plan and quickly, because it wasn't great, you know, not having our own place to live and so on. So that's what brought us to Mountain View and connected us initially with this community, is that Tim got a job in Palo Alto, and I got the job that I have now working for this nonprofit. And, you know, I feel so grateful for the way that we landed. And I feel so grateful for the different, we have these various sanghas that we're part of, Everyday Zen being one that sort of merged with here. And I continue to have teachers, Victoria Austin from San Francisco Zen Center, and I'll go to retreats with Zenju Earthlyn Manuel, wonderful teacher. If you haven't read her books, highly recommend. And so there's such a richness and support, you know, back continuing here in the Bay Area. And there's still this question for me, like, how can I re-engage with this work where I really feel like called to be able to care for the world through working in mindfulness and education? And so I'm just holding that, and I'm talking to people, and I'm learning what I can, and coming up with ideas and sharing those. So yeah, there's many dreams that I have, like we could have a program that's themed around training new classroom teachers, you know, one of those themed teacher residency programs that's all about how to be mindful in everything that you do as a teacher. And, you know, when we talk about math, we can talk about math anxiety and how to bring mindfulness to that, and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I'm noticing that enthusiasm there and kind of holding it along with some sense of heartbreak. Like it's been a difficult time for me in these last few years, having lost that opportunity in Bhutan, working from home, which can be very isolating, continuing to have health issues that intersect with us trying to have a child and struggling with that for the last 4 years. And yeah, and I remember Gil Fronsdell telling me, you know, the more that you suffer, the more you need to turn to practice. And so that's what I'm trying to do, and I need all the help I can get. So I just continue to appreciate being in these sanghas and feeling inspired by other people who share similar intentions. So I just want to, I know this is a Way Seeking Mind topic, and I've told you quite a bit about my life, and I just want to close with a koan that probably a lot of you have heard before, but it's one of my favorites, and I think it relates to this idea about, you know, how do we care? How do we do this caring for ourselves and others? So this is case 89 from the Blue Cliff Record. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes? Dao Wu said, it's just like someone reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night. Yunyan said, I understand. Hands and eyes cover the whole body. Dao Wu said, what you said is all right, but it's only 80% of it. Yunyan said, I'm like this, elder brother. How do you understand it? Dao Wu said, hands and eyes are throughout the entire body. So if you haven't heard this before, you know, it starts off with, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use these hands and eyes? How do they do this of being compassionate, acting in the world, seeing the suffering and acting in the world? And it's natural. It's just like when you're half asleep and you're adjusting your pillow. And so, oh, okay. So then it's everything, but it's all of my body is covered in these hands and eyes. And it's like, even more so, hands and eyes are throughout the entire body. You know, you're acting out of this intimate loving kindness because that's your practice moving through you. So yeah, in these times where I have felt a lot of discouragement, I find myself remembering this koan over and over and just having this wish that my practice can move through me and I can feel like I don't have to try so hard and make things happen that I can, you know, but just to try to let it flow through me naturally, enacted through my whole body. So thanks everyone for your kind attention. And I don't know, do we have time if people have questions? Wonderful. Did you have a question,
Josh? Yes. Hi, my name is Julian.
Julian.
Your name is again?
My name is Camille.
Hi, Camille.
Julian, go closer.
Oh, sure, that's fine. So I'm going to need a little leeway or indulgence, the way you sort of ask a judge to go on. Something, right, a special sort of question that is sort of an intuitive one, not an intellectual one at this point. And to elicit your intuitions as well to help solve this riddle, I'm going to have to ask sort of like a back and forth rather than a one-part question or a multi-part question, if you'll indulge me. And if anyone else has any insight or something, we get stuck, please feel free to chime in. Are you willing to do that?
Oh, Let me know what your question is, and we'll just
Okay.
see where it goes.
So let's start with if you could distill it into four key points, how would you articulate the humanistic values of your parents?
Well, I think I'm not going to be bound by four, but I will just say I think that it was about trying to think about how we can care for the well-being of everyone in society, regardless of what the circumstances are of how that person was born
so
or aspects of
compassion.
Themselves.
Compassion without attachment.
Sure.
Okay, what else?
Yeah, I think I would rather have this conversation a little bit later, just in the sense that I'm feeling like it's bringing me into my head. I'm not finding a way to stay in my heart and my body as I think about humanism right now.
Okay. In that case, what do you feel is causing that sort of feeling?
I'd like to interject.
Please do.
Please ask Dowell the question from your heart.
Okay. At the risk of making it sound like an assumption, your response conveys to me the assumption that I'm not. So if you are still willing to speculate as to where that feeling is going.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can answer your question directly.
That's fine.
But it's making me think about a few things. I mean, I remember that my grandpa Bill, my mom's dad, was always very suspicious of me practicing Zen, you know, and he was very proud. He would say, like, I'm a secular humanist, and he saw Zen as superstition. You know, he grew up and he was going to, you know, the Jewish school his mom sent him as a child. And he asked questions and he kept questioning, and that particular rabbi did not like the type of questions he was asking, and he, you know, kind of shut him down. And he told his mom, like, I'm not going back. I need to be able to question things. And I just always thought it was sad, because to me, questioning is one of the things at the heart of Zen. Like, I always was trying to kind of talk to my grandpa, like, I see them as very much the same thing. Like, I see humanism as part of Zen, and I didn't see anything in conflict between the way that I engaged with Zen and what I could understand from his beliefs. But he had this notion of what Zen was. So that's one thing that just arose as I was thinking about this. And a second thing I would say is I am remembering this quote about compassion. We've done a lot of discussion about compassion with Zen, with Reb Anderson, because it's one of his favorite topics. And he talks a lot about great compassion. And so he talks about kind of ordinary compassion is when you feel the sort of sympathy and, you know, oh, somebody is struggling and you want to help, but you are quite attached to the outcomes. And so if I help and then you don't actually benefit from my help, I'm going to be very disappointed. I might even be angry with you, which is, you know, it's a human thing. And so he's sort of saying, then you can eventually get to the second stage of a more detached compassion, where you're not attached to the outcomes. And then eventually you can have this great compassion where you're not even attached to being detached. Like, it's just flowing out naturally. And so I think that came up also thinking about your question, because it's like hard for me to talk about compassion like too directly sometimes. Like, if I try to think about it, you know, think about care and compassion and stuff like that in a particular way, and somehow I, you know, that's what was coming up for me, then it, it feels like I'm going to sell it short or something. Like, there's, yeah, sometimes I have to kind of stop and think about these koans or about these teachings that, and I know I'm not there yet. Like, I can talk about them and I find them inspiring and awe-inspiring, in part because I'm like that. Maybe I've felt that a little bit sometimes, but it's more of a practice. It's more of like an embodied feeling that, you know, the words are just a finger pointing at the moon. Did anybody else have any? I'd like to give other people a chance, Julian. I'm happy to check in afterwards.
Sure.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Dawu, for your talk. I've over the years heard many way-seeking mind talks in this room, and I can't think of any of them that were as moving as yours.
Oh, thank you.
I was really struck by your story of so early in your career trying to teach algebra in Memphis. And it sounds like you both did a wonderful job and practically destroyed yourself doing it.
Yeah.
Now, as you look at ways of helping other teachers bring mindfulness into education, do you sometimes think if you could go back, you know, transport yourself in a time machine and talk to yourself back then, would some of those insights have helped you so early in your career, both with your students and with yourself, teaching algebra in Memphis?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because I do think about that sometimes. And I think about it also because I see myself still running into issues with work. Like, I think that I do have a tendency still to get very identified with work, and part of it comes from a very healthy motivation of wanting to help people. And some of it comes from more a sense of, I need to do this in order to be a good person and to fulfill my duty, and, you know, maybe like a scarcity mentality. It's one of those tricky things, because it's like, no, things really are problems. Like, you know, there's really suffering and it's really wrong. And some of the things I saw in Memphis just, just continued to drive that home for me in my memories. And at the same time, yeah, there's a sort of way that if I focus on that and I think that I have to fix it, then that's just going to continue to be problematic. So for sure, like, I wish that I could go back to my earlier self. And, you know, I think some of it would have been leaning into Sangha maybe even more. We had a little Sangha in town and they were very supportive, but I think if there had been a way for me to really feel like I could lean on other people and know that this is the effort that I'm giving. I'm giving myself fully, and that has to be enough. Like that, I'm doing this as my practice, and that's it. Yeah, but even now, I think I still need to continue to internalize that sort of thing, honestly. I see that there's one online from Anna. Go ahead.
Thank you for your talk. You made a comment that struck me about your appreciation for Zen forms, and also you missing the smiles that you experienced at other retreats. And I don't think I've ever heard that explicitly pointed out before, but I know what you mean. So I guess I wonder if you think that smiling can go with our Zen forms in a bigger way.
Yeah. I think if I were, yeah, to feel like I could choose, at least in this moment, I would say, I think in the, when we're engaging in ceremony, that's not a, you know, if we're approaching the altar and we're bowing and things like that, generally, I feel like those are times when I don't feel like people need to be making eye contact and smiling and things like that. It kind of would take away from it. I think maybe in Zen, we can look for that more. Even during a sesshin, it could happen at certain points and you know, maybe certain times of the day, especially when we're not in sesshin, I think, just looking for those opportunities. And that's one of the wonderful things about Kanendo, is we do go in the courtyard and talk and have tea and such when we're here in person and smile at one another. So I think, yeah, some of my favorite teachers too, I've seen them, you know, all of a sudden, you know, break into smile and hug someone in the Zendo. And it's wonderful in part because, you know, they're not always having to do that. You know, like it's a, you can tell that it's just very genuine and authentic. Okay. Yeah, maybe one more. I know we're getting a little close on time. Yeah.
I just want to thank you for sharing your story and how, showing us how through hardships, being mindful helped you. And that's a good reminder. Thank you.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanendo Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanendo.org. That's kanendo.org.